Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Jim Oinas, and he will be doing a Bible study on Luke 7, 36 through 50. So let's listen in on Jim.
Even after doing a lot of work in Luke now, I still like Mark better. So I'm saying that simply because I'd like you to go around and say your name. And just mention a book of the Bible that's sort of your favorite, or maybe a story in the Bible, or if that doesn't come to your mind, whatever story in the Bible just pops into your head right now. So I'm Jim, and I think I still like the Gospel of Mark best. Go ahead.
I'm Judy Madison, and I still like the Gospel of Mark best.
Oh.
Is there an echo in here?
Yeah.
Shirley Anderson. I don't know what gospel I like best.
Could be any book in the Bible.
Yeah. I like the parable of the sower.
I'm Bob Niedringhaus. I like John the best.
I'm Chuck Anderson. I kind of like some of the parts of Romans that talk about hope.
Herman Larson. Romans.
Well, I was going to say Mark because somebody said it. You want to ask somebody to read the Bible who's never read the Bible, especially the New Testament, tell them to start with Mark.
Uh-huh.
But I like Ephesians, which says what we, that one verse I can't quote it, but Ephesians is what we believe. What is it? About faith. You know.
Who are you?
I am Joanne Henderson.
I'm Karen Hoskin, and I like Philippians.
Hey, I'm Walker, and I like the Christmas story.
I'm Christian and John.
We'll just go back there.
I'm Steve Knudsen. Kind of like everything that everybody else likes, but I think one of the things is maybe just a little different to throw out. Is I like a little section in the third chapter of Lamentations where Jeremiah has been wailing on for 2.5 chapters about how bad things are as Jerusalem is falling, and then he comes out and he says, "But in this I have hope, you know, that you know the love of God is new every morning," and you know, he brings out this little flash of hope out of the midst of all this despair. It always helps.
Man. And you just came in. And what's your name? We're talking about our names and what kind of book of the Bible or what story you like best.
I'm Jody Snorenson, and I think Mark. That's a
blue
too. Yeah. Chuck Anderson, one of the underappreciated books in the Bible that I think is very important, Acts. Acts of the Apostles.
I'm Bruce Eklund, and I think I like Psalms best, the diversity of the feeling that it expresses.
I'm Anne Niedringhaus, and I think maybe parts of Isaiah.
I'm Bob Gullo, and I haven't bonded to any one particular part. Mostly it depends on what my attitude is for the day, you know, or for the week, better stated. And I end up moving sometimes to laments, and they are clearly my favorite when I'm in the lamenting phase. and sometimes the psalms for rejoicing, and sometimes the gospels more toward Mark, I suspect, than the other thing. But,
isn't it great that we have such a thick book here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about the angels up there?
Mm-hmm. I'm Marcia Riggers, and probably I would pick the 17th chapter of John. Despite its convoluted nature, it kind of reminds me of who I am.
My name is Susan Briel, and my favorite book of the Bible is the Book of Ruth.
Okay, well, the gospel for this Sunday is Luke 7:36, and the Lutheran one ends at the end of the chapter, but I thought we'd just take a look at, as far as the Roman Catholic one goes, through verse 3, because I think it probably a reason why that's included. So that's the gospel. And then I'd like to read for you the verses to come right before this. As you all know, when you read a novel, or something like if you start in the middle, it's hard to understand it. And I think the Gospels especially are that way, and probably most of the books of the Bible, in that are sort of the way that we hear these stories so much is like, for example, on Sunday, and we just get part of it, and it's hard for us to really understand what it's all about. And for example, Luke or Mark or John probably would say something in the early part of their book that they may not even refer to again until later in chapters. So we can't read the whole book of Luke right now, but I'd like to just read the verses that come before this to kind of give us a little context, because I think part of this relates. To what then will I compare the people of this generation, and what are they like? They are like children sitting in the marketplace and calling to one another. I've started at verse 31 and 32. They called to one another, saying, "We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We wailed, and you did not weep. For John the Baptist has come eating no bread and drinking no wine. And you say, 'He has a demon.' The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, 'Look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.' Nevertheless, wisdom is vindicated by all her children." Then, would someone like to read the gospel lesson for Sunday, which is 7:36, and then we'll go all the way through 8:3. Anyone want to do that?
Sure.
Okay.
"And one of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him. And he went into the Pharisee's house and sat down to meat. And behold, a woman in the city, which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment, and stood at his feet behind him weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears, and did wipe them with the hairs of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee, which had been him, saw it, he spake within himself, saying, 'This man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that touches him, for she is a sinner.' And Jesus answering said unto him, 'Simon, I have something to say unto you. And he said, 'Master, say on.' There was a certain creditor which had two debtors. The one owed him 500 pence, and the other 50. And when they had nothing to pay, he frankly forgave them both. Tell me therefore, which of them will love him the most? Simon answered and said, 'I suppose that he to whom he forgave most.' And he said unto him, 'Thou hast judged rightly.' And he turned to the woman and said to Simon, 'See thou this woman? I entered into thine house. Thou gavest me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with tears and wiped them with the hairs of her head. Thou gavest me no kiss, but this woman, since the time I came in, hath not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil thou didst not anoint, but this woman hath anointed my feet with ointment. Wherefore I say unto thee, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loveth little. And he said unto her, Thy sins are forgiven. And they that sat at meat with him began to say within themselves, Who is this that forgiveth sins also? And he said to the woman, Thy faith has saved thee. Go in peace. And it came to pass afterward that he went throughout every city and village, preaching and showing the glad tidings of the kingdom of God, and the 12 were with him. And certain women, which had been healed of evil spirits and infirmities, Mary called Magdalene, out of whom went 7 devils, and Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's steward, and Susanna, and many others which ministered unto him of their substance."
I think, although it's impossible for us to know exactly what people were thinking and how they felt in that society, I think it's important for us to try to understand a little bit of what, how that society functions, if we can, anyway. But let's talk a little bit about, for example, in our society, what are the kind of things that happen that give people power or make them important or make them able to function and just make us able to function in society? What are some of the ones that happen in our society? How does it function?
Money.
Money, okay. And how does that work?
Well, we respect materialism, so we like, we think it's important to have stuff, material, goods. Mm-hmm. And I think we give our power to people like that.
Okay, yeah. In fact, we could, and sometimes people could do some things that we would think very dishonorable or shameful or whatever, but if they accumulate a lot of money, somehow they still are given lots of power, or we still, in a way, honor them, don't we? Sometimes. Yeah. One of the commentators I was reading, actually last year when we were talking about Mark, said that probably, although these things all relate, that Jesus lived more than we do in what would be called an honor and a shame society. And so it was very interesting that Os was here at the early Bible study, Os Matsutani, and he picked up on a lot of these things that were in this just sort of almost naturally. But for example, you'll find in the Bible, you'll find people bowing to each other a lot, or you'll find things happening between people that have to be described, otherwise we wouldn't understand what was going on. And even if they describe it to us, we a lot of times don't understand. But Jesus lived in a, and predominantly, although money played a big part in it, was not the only thing. The honor in society was very important in that society. And it was sort of an honor-shame society, which is a very simplistic way to put it, but just to help us sort of compare a little bit to our society. What are, just those of, a lot of you here have studied the Bible a lot. What are some of the things that you can pick up that happens in this story that would have to do with these relationships? In other words, for example, this, like if Jesus were meeting with a bunch of people today, what kind of a meeting would this might have been? Or you think of?
Well, the Pharisees, church leaders, so church leaders.
Okay. Do any of you have done any reading lately on who the Pharisees were, or have you? This guy was a leader of the Pharisees, huh? Or it doesn't really say he was a leader, just one of the Pharisees. Have any of you done any?
Well, they were the rather liberal intelligentsia, I guess, if you will, of their time, as opposed to maybe the Sadducees, who were more conservative and bound up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Really kept track of the law, didn't they? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At least recently, it seems like, and I can't speak for everyone, but what I've read lately is that the Pharisees really probably were not as different from Jesus as we have sort of picked up traditionally from the Gospels. And in fact, the fact that Jesus is always relating to Pharisees indicates that he at least had some discourse with them, and that they probably didn't disagree on everything. And one commentator I read said that, for example, Jesus seemed to really talk a lot about an afterlife, and the Pharisees also supported the idea of a possible afterlife, whereas maybe the Sadducees, we don't know for sure, didn't. And that, I'm sure there were different opinions in each camp too that varied. But so anyway, we probably don't need to think, well, like it's been in the past, Pharisee bad, you know. I mean, we need to look at just who this is. What are some of the things that happen here, though, that might be sort of turning things upside down? What are some of the things just from what you know about that culture. So what is happening here? Who? One commentator I read that is, Jesus is probably at a symposium. In other words, this is, you know, today we might call it a symposium. But when you ate together in that society, what did that mean?
Well, it was quite the honor to be invited to someone's table, just like it would be in our society, actually. I mean, if you invite somebody to sit down and eat with you and to discuss the matters of the day and religious thoughts, that's a pretty much an honor, although I'm sure that they were probably looking at Jesus as being something the outside rebel, and he is coming up with some very new and different things, and we're not really sure we believe him, but we certainly want to hear what he has to say so we can figure out how to take it apart.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, weren't the Pharisees also trying, or wasn't it their position of power in the religious society to tell the believers or masses how to live?
Mm-hmm. Well,
they were
actually one of the parties, and the way we need to look at it, I think, is that when Jesus, and this would help us with this story, when Jesus was there, and most likely was probably, as far as we can tell, although correct me if I'm wrong, and there might be recent studies that would correct this, it might have been mostly just men that were meeting and eating together there in that kind of a situation where it says that these are Pharisees. And they were probably discussing, you know, how do we interpret these laws in Leviticus? How does our society function right now? What is it like? And they would probably discuss scripture back and forth, because those were the laws for them, and that scripture was really that important. And so they were probably talking about those kind of things.
I would think from that, Jesus was kind of there to straighten them out a little bit. and that they have you read the new book Joshua by Grisoni? Okay, it's a novel, and I probably shouldn't get into it at this point, but so I won't. But it seems like maybe because Jesus was who he was, the Jewish faith had come to a certain point where God needed to have Jesus there because the people, God's people, were not having the freedom to make their own decisions. They were having to be told by the hierarchy how to.
What are some of the things that this woman does that probably were sort of shocking?
The fact that she was there.
Okay, the fact that she was there. What are some of the other things?
A sinner, there are many interpretations of what they meant. She was a sinner, so.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. She was touching Jesus.
Okay, yeah. Why was that so bad or shocking or whatever?
I just, at least what I've been told is that theirs was a culture that basically the separation of the sexes was really significant, and that that, you know, touching in public places in particular was not something that was done.
Okay. Take a look. Let's look at those verses. What does she do? Let's go in the beginning here. And then verse 37, and a woman in the city who was a sinner, it's very well pointed out, right? Having learned that he was eating in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster jar of ointment. Do any of you know what might be the symbolism of that? She brings this ointment.
Well, that's typically used for burial purposes, wasn't it?
Sometimes for burial, yeah.
And
just sort of a commentary, a story that's almost like this, occurs at the end of Mark. And it's right before Jesus dies. And this woman comes and puts it on his head. And we don't know if it's the same story or a different story, but and it's almost like symbolizing that Jesus is being anointed, like the kings were anointed and everything, but he's being anointed now for his death. In this being way early in the story, it probably doesn't mean that. And it's not on his head like it is in Mark. But it is something, it means it's somehow she's really making him important because the kings were anointed with oil and those kind of things.
Anointing was a ritual part of installation for important office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She didn't do anything official, but she was indicating.
Mm-hmm. Also from Jesus' comment that Simon didn't give him any oil for his head, that I think wasn't, as I remember, it wasn't that kind of a welcoming thing and a way of refreshing. Mm-hmm. Another thing of having a servant come over to wash the feet of the guests after they came in off the dirty roads was a refreshing kind of thing in the heat of the desert. And
mm-hmm.
I think the oil was too, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah.
Kind of freshened up.
Maybe someone else knows more about oil here. What else does she do?
Cries over his feet.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, she cries over his feet. And what else does she do for his feet?
Kisses.
She kisses him. Yeah. Do you any of you know about this whole? You remember when Jesus heals the person who has blind? How does he do that? And I think that's in Mark. Yeah, he spits on the dirt and puts the dirt on the person's eye. What would that tell us about her kissing his? And another thing to know is that would have probably been very shocking. That was sort of breaking the honor thing because spittle was, if you look through Leviticus and stuff, is considered impure. You're not supposed to exchange. So if you spit on someone or something, you're really not supposed to exchange those bodily fluids because it's really considered impure. And so what does she do? She's kissing his feet. What about feet? Do any of you, have you ever heard these TV commentaries about when our officials go over to meet with people in the Mideast, what they're taught? That you really have to, like what Chuck's doing to me here, boy, he's really insulting me as far as I can tell. He's got the backs of his feet up like this. And so the feet, I don't understand it because I don't live in that society, but evidently there's a lot about the parts of the body and the feet, and she's kissing his feet. So I think that is also... I think if we just can't understand this, but I think if we would have heard this story right after Luke had written it, it would have been so much more dramatic to us and so much powerful, maybe even insulting to us, depending on who we were. What?
She also has her hair down.
Yeah, okay, what might that mean?
Well, that's debasing herself.
Okay. Some of us, this we can't know, but because we don't live then, but we can kind of imagine, I guess.
Her unloosing her hair in the presence of men must have been an act of extreme humiliation.
Hmm. Hmm. Okay.
Does it say how the Pharisees reacted to this?
I don't know. What do you see?
I don't see it. It just goes on to the next story of what Jesus did.
Uh-huh.
Well, they use it as an example of why he must not be who he says he is, because he can't, don't you know who this person is? Mm-hmm. So they use it at first as proof that he isn't, he isn't who he says he is, because he wouldn't allow this woman.
Right.
He would know who she was.
A couple things that I just really appreciate about just Luke's writing here is that I'm starting to appreciate that more and more. is what Luke uses with what the woman does here is, I think, a common narrative device in especially Hebrew literature, is just to pile up phrases and repeat things. In other words, she doesn't just loosen her hair, she kisses his feet, and she washes his feet with her hair. I mean, it just goes on and on. And so it really, that's sort of a device to really increase the drama, to help us understand, or at least get into the feeling of what's happening. Now there's an irony here too, of what you just brought up. And what is this irony about him not, according to the Pharisee, not knowing who she is? What's the irony?
The irony is that at least that you may be pointing to, is that she's got actions and he is only thinking.
Okay, there's one, yeah.
And the fact that he makes you, that actually the lesson he's going to tell is really based on who she is. So he probably knows, the irony is he knows probably more about her than those people do, because then he uses the story of forgiving more. Mm-hmm. So they imply he doesn't know about her, that he uses that fact, who she is to make her.
You know, there's never any indication as to why the woman was doing this. It seems like it's not important to the story.
Uh-huh.
It was just the fact that she did do this,
right,
that is being reflected, but there was no indication as to whether she had had a previous experience with Jesus, or that she, you know, knew of him and was asking for forgiveness or that kind of thing. There was never any, the intention of the incident is totally blank.
Mm-hmm. We might get towards the end a little bit of an idea, or I think as we talk about it.
There's a little parallelism here, though, in the fact that they must be saying, who does she think she is?
Right.
And then later they say, who does he think he is?
Jesus.
When he forgives her.
Yeah, right. The irony here that I find is that Simon says, you don't know who this woman is. But what ends up happening is Jesus knows what Simon is thinking. And so Jesus proves that he's a prophet by knowing what Simon's thinking. And he proves in the long run that he really knows what's going on in this woman's life. And he shows that this woman really knows what's important in life. Whereas Simon doesn't. Simon is all bound up with the rules, and he's all concerned with, you know, doing everything correctly and all this. And what's important to this woman? What are some of the values she brings? Take a look at the text here.
Well, basically, she realizes that she's the sinner in need of God's grace and forgiveness. And one way that she can get that is to make her own commitment to Jesus and recognize him and say that, you know, in effect that he is the source of her salvation. And Simon is sitting around there still evaluating all the facts and taking in information. He hasn't really made any commitment yet.
Okay.
He's still, you know, trying to figure this whole thing out.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. He's made a commitment. That's or she has. Let's take a look at verse 32, and I want to point this out. This is a fun thing to learn, that I learned about, and it helps understand a lot of how the Bible is written. Because if you look at this verse, I take a look at verse 32, actually the sort of poetic part, where it says, we played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We wailed, and you did not weep. For John the Baptist has come eating no bread and drinking no wine, and you say, he has a demon. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, look, a glutton and a drunkard. This is what's called a chiasm in literature, and this happens again and again, especially in the Gospels. And what happens is those first two lines that talk about playing the flute and dancing relate to the last two lines that talk about Jesus.
In other words, they say, and the Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, look, a glutton and a drunkard. In other words, we played the flute, and you didn't dance, refers to Jesus, right? And then it talks, and then it's explained down here, right? You go get it? Then the middle two lines refer to, you know, we mourned and wept, and they refer to John the Baptist. And it's called a chiasm because the letter looks like an X to us, letter chi in Greek, as it looks like that. And so you have these two lines that relate to these two and these two that relate to these two. And I think it helps us because as a lot of people have studied that we have in our society for a long time taught everyone to think in linear fashion, one thing after another, you never skip over, you always have to go, or you never go around the other side to the other side of the globe or something.
Why not?
Yeah. You know, you just have to go orderly. That's not the way people in every culture think, and that's not the way poetry often works and things like that. I mean, so it's like a novel, you know, you can start in the beginning and skip back and forth. Anyway, but now the meaning of this, how would you say, like I think, in that these words, we piped for you and you did not dance, how does that relate to what's going on in this story?
The Pharisees just don't want to be pleased. They want to pick and they want to be unhappy with everything that comes their way. You know, they say, we piped for you and you did not dance. It's like the kids who wanted to play Wedding, which is one of their favorite games, and so they would play pipes and dance around and be happy. Well, they didn't like that. And then they said, well, okay, so let's mourn and weep and pretend that we're at a funeral, which is another fun thing to go do. And well, you didn't like that either. So.
Okay. But who did both dance? Who did both dance and mourn and weep in this story? In a way, dance. I don't mean really dance, but...
The woman.
The woman, yeah. Doesn't she dance for joy in a way, yet also weep for her sins? I mean, she's found a way. She's found a way to be relieved of her sin or her past or her separation or isolation, and she just comes in and she is in a way dancing. She's also mourning and weeping, and this story really is explained in a way by that little thing, I think. Some of you look puzzled, maybe you don't agree with me. Let's talk about those words.
Well, the part we played the flute for you and you did not dance, who is that referring to? I thought maybe Jesus.
I'd say that would refer to Jesus.
Jesus, yes. Jesus plays the flute. He plays the flute.
He plays.
And what do you think that means, plays the flute?
He's talking about he's making a statement about the people of the day when the music plays and they ought to be joyful, they're disgruntled.
Yeah.
When there's sadness and things that you should be wailing about, they aren't connected. It's like they're lukewarm.
Yeah, and what's keeping them disconnected? And what's in this story? What's keeping Simon from getting connected?
Well, it's sort of, we talked a little about the analysis, the rules and all that, that no matter what goes on, maybe the way you do it is with analysis and, you know, trying to figure it out rather than somehow getting involved with what's happening.
Okay.
And so if it's happiness, if it's joyful, you analyze it and you sit back and you watch it. If it's sad, the same.
Okay.
When I was in high school and college, there was a phrase called losing your cool. I know every age has kind of that same thing, but it's the inability, essentially, because of the pressure of the crowd or the
the feeling vulnerable. I mean, that certainly has something to do with it in terms of expressing your true feelings.
Yeah.
And boy, you don't want to lose your cool. And in a sense, that's at least how I feel that the two extremes are threatening to your kind of place or your ability to kind of be dignified and be part of the group.
Yeah. I think, you know, Jesus came piping a tune. He really was piping. And maybe I could tell you what I think part of his tune was. Just to give you, when I was in Phoenix, I worked a lot with Central American refugees, but it was also a poor part of town that also there were getting to be more and more, as years went on, more and more homeless people that were actually from the U.S., you know. And every once in a while, someone would come into the church, and I would start to talk to this person, and I would find out that this person was on the streets, they were homeless, they didn't have any money or anything. But I remember this one guy, started talking to him, and I found out that he had a brother living out in this place called Paradise Valley, which is a kind of richer part of town, in this great big house, extremely wealthy. And here's this guy, he's down in the streets, doesn't have anything. And it hadn't been long. I mean, this guy had been within like 9 months that this guy had ended up on the streets. And what we tend to do, you know, is probably what had happened to this woman, is what Jesus was trying to say. This woman is not as far off as you want to make. We have this way in societies all through history of just within a matter of minutes or a month or a year of making people outsiders, outcasts. You know? And we all of a sudden think that's the way that person has always been, or and they're an outsider and that's their fault. And, well, it could be, but I think, don't you think that that's what Jesus came piping? This woman is a part of us. She's with us. She's one of us. And he really accepts her in. And Simon isn't able to do that, is he? And so it just seems like that's part of the tune of what Jesus is piping. How do these verses that in chapter 8 refer to that, or kind of help us with that too? How does this help us understand what Jesus might have been about, what he was doing? What do you think? What is our sort of typical understanding of the followers of Jesus? Sort of the things that we've been taught that kind of has come down to us.
Amen.
Okay.
Right.
You think it's an accident that Luke puts these verses right after this story? What do you think he's telling us?
Is the woman one of the unmentioned women in these three verses?
Could well be, yeah.
Or was becoming one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think of the followers of Jesus as kind of down and out people. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but that's...
I read a book not long ago that this person called the followers of Jesus a group of healed healers. That Jesus, you know, one of the things we do pretty well know for sure is that Jesus organized people and then sent them out probably by twos or maybe sometimes by fours. And they went out and something wonderful happened wherever they went, you know. We weren't there, we don't know exactly how it happened, but they went out and they really healed. That the society started to heal from that ministry. And so one of the things we're seeing here is what would be not just the healing that had to occur for these women, but what were some of the separations that were overcome?
Well, I've always liked the fact that Mary Magdalene here is revealed as having had seven demons, but no one knows what the problem was with Mary Magdalene, except that the church over the years, especially the later church, decided she was a prostitute. And so that's how we've all come to think she was.
Yeah.
And there's no indication of that anyplace, yeah, biblically.
Right. That's also with this story. I remember somebody in the last Bible study just automatically referred to this woman who put the oil on Jesus as a prostitute. But it doesn't say that. It just says she was a sinner. Unless someone else can figure out why someone would say that. But
I'll figure out some other reason why. What else would she be doing? I guess that would make her a sinner, mm-hmm, you know, in the eyes of the gospel.
Well,
it's
just gossip.
But being a prostitute's the worst sinner, so.
Well,
from our perspective,
you know, it may be that she just defied the customs of the time. Yes. That's how I interpret it. It's just more, I mean, you don't have to be a prostitute to basically kind of think, you know, these rules are dumb.
Yeah.
You know, why? I'm just not going to live by them. And then she, you know, it takes a certain kind of strength, mm-hmm, to swim upstream when the rest of the community is going downstream too. And so at least that's one of another way of I think, of looking at that.
Don't you think one reason people always think about the prostitute thing is that we're kind of uncomfortable with this touch stuff and the fact, and the letting down of the hair and all of this, and it was very physical, very caregiving, and we have a hard time with that. So if someone starts being that nurturing with their touch and to someone they don't know, we right away sort of take it to the extreme.
Okay.
Is not necessarily the extreme, however. No. That is, I mean, if in fact she was prostitute, her actions are not extremes at all.
Yeah,
in
terms of the regular society.
Nor is what we would call the nurturing out of character for someone who was prostitute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
I just had a question in terms of, did the sexual innuendos around that, did that primarily an American interpretation, or is that something goes back to...
Yeah. Well, it goes back to the church.
You bet.
Yeah. Medieval, especially. And, this stuff didn't start to appear as a prostitute until later.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, that's
but it isn't American. It's modeled on us.
That sexual sins were quite... the worst.
Yeah.
What are some of the, are there any more ironies that you pick up here, or?
Now, one of the things, I guess, you know, I think when most people read this, when I always read this parable, it seems to me that the biggest thing that Jesus is trying to teach here is the difference between Simon and this woman. I mean, mm-hmm, he says, Simon, I have something to tell you. I mean, I think that's the crux of the whole thing, that these guys probably invited Jesus in to kind of try to figure out, you know, either they kind of wanted him to kind of become one of the boys, or they wanted to kind of find out what he was really like so they could kind of write him off.
Curious.
And they were curious about him. But what he wanted to tell Simon was summed up in this parable of the moneylender. I mean, what he's really doing is saying, is comparing the woman to Simon. And then, actually, in the next paragraph, he kind of goes after Simon. I mean, I came in your house and you didn't do anything for me.
Yeah.
And so he's pretty tough on Simon.
Yeah.
Pretty tough on Simon.
Yeah.
So he would forgive him a little, love a little.
Right.
And it seems to me that he's kind of saying, the worse off you are, he kind of admits that this woman is a bigger sinner than Simon, mm-hmm, because of the money in her story.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also saying that the person who needs it the most is the one who's going to love the most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, that's to me, I think, an irony, isn't it? I mean, in a way, or is it? It's beyond, way beyond. It's kind of belittling to say it's an irony. It's much more than that.
It's kind of turning everything upside down, because in a way, what I think he's implying is that the value system
is who loves the most.
Right.
Rather than who needs the least forgiveness.
Yeah.
So it's turning the whole system.
They live in a system where the person who lived the purest life,
right,
who needed the least forgiveness,
uh-huh,
was the one who was elevated, yeah, the most.
Right.
And so here you say, just the opposite. Mm-hmm. The one who's,
yeah,
the one who's been the worst,
mm-hmm,
is the one who is elevated the most in my eyes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But then he says to her, your sins are forgiven. He doesn't say that to Simon, but he's, mm-hmm, not ready yet.
Mm-hmm. And Simon probably still, I don't need that bunch of sins forgiven, probably, mm-hmm, yeah, right?
Yeah, I think that's the most troubling part of the story, because it starts setting up a scale. Mm-hmm. That's when I think that it's the, mm-hmm, the most helpful to go back to the imagery of the chiasm that you started with. When you talk about children saying to children, I piped and you didn't dance,
mm-hmm,
and I think of a bunch of kids trying to get another kid to start to play with them. And watch the kids around here getting someone else to come and play with them. And watch a child who really doesn't want to go and play or isn't sure they want to yet, and they're kind of, they start, you know, a half dance around dad's leg or mom's leg,
mm-hmm,
but they don't really enter in.
Mm-hmm.
I can play with that imagery and be much more comfortable than I can with this scaling of,
Isn't the scale thing here, you know, that kind of gets referred to? In a way, don't we need to think about that in a way we need to think about parables? In other words,
sure,
Jesus has a point here, but let's not take it so far as to say, okay, I'm forgiven for 50 sins, and you're forgiven for 100 sins, so therefore you're a more forgiven person.
Yeah.
In other words, that then we're doing just the, we're setting up another scale, just like Simon did. Simon
said,
I have less sins, so I'm a better person, and Jesus makes it the opposite. Okay, she sinned more, so she, it's not, the point is not, I think Anne's point is what is it really is what is the value system? In other words, is love the value system here, or is it really, because in a way Jesus says that out of this forgiveness, or from the forgiveness, or to the forgiveness comes love. And then also there's three words that sort of, I've often found this, you see if you agree with me in the Bible, is that there is at sometimes a point when some of the big words of the Bible all converge and you can't really separate them. In the long run, can you really separate these three words in a story? Forgiveness, love, and faith. Aren't they all tied together? But Jesus says your faith has healed you, or something. What does he say in the end? That your faith...
Your faith has saved you.
Has what?
Has saved you.
Has saved you, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Your faith has saved you. And then he talks about she loves much because she's forgiven, or then another version says she forgives much. Or it's because in the Greek you can't really, how does that phrase go? You'll see a difference in the Revised Standard and the New Revised. What verse is that here?
47.
47, okay. Therefore I tell you, her sins, which were many, have been forgiven. Hence, she has shown great love. How is it in the Old Revised?
Therefore I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much.
Okay. So that makes it sound like because she loved much, in our way of talking, therefore her sins are forgiven.
Yeah, it was the love first.
But here it says hence.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when you translate the Greek, you can't really tell. And it's all kind of part of one act, just one
whole value system. Forgiveness and love are all tied up together. You aren't able to love because you've been forgiven a lot. That's not necessarily so. They're all kind of together. And the faith thing here is also in there.
This one puts even a little different spin on it, which is the Good News Bible. I tell you then, the great love she has shown proves that her many sins have been forgiven.
Yeah.
Which is
you can see the translators really struggling with this, and they because and part of Lutherans just would really struggle with this, you know, because we had said you just have to have faith first, then you'll be able to love. You know, there's no way you could love first and then have faith. You know.
Yeah. The only image that I've been able to deal with is one that's quite frankly personal and I've been asked on a number of occasions by a number of organizations to be financially supportive of that organization. And I've looked at it and said, well, you know, they're really asking a whole lot more than what we can handle or what anyone would be justifiably doing. And then my wife has MS and a drug has released that is not covered by insurance, but it costs $1,200 a month. And they're even questioning the world as to whether or not I'm going to do it. But if any organization had asked me to spend $1,200 a month in support of them, I'd have told them to take a flying leap. I mean, it's the nature of a relationship, and where are we going to invest ourselves? And it isn't a matter of more or less. It isn't a scaling. It's a where are we?
This is one of those things, though. I mean, if you were gonna sit down with a bunch of homeless people or a bunch of people from Central America and read this story, they'd see it differently, wouldn't they, Jim?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're interpreting this. We're trying to figure out.
Everyone interprets it through
that. Yeah. We're trying to figure out how this fits for us.
Yeah.
If you sat down with a bunch of people who were all a bunch of people like this woman, mm-hmm. who saw themselves. As people like this woman, disadvantaged, homeless, sinners, they would see this as God's purpose in the world. The people would say, this supports the idea that Christ preferred the poor, that this scale and this monument of parable is real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what I was trying to lead up as to why we should include these verses in 8. Who are these people that are made the central part of Jesus' band of followers or groups or who are with Jesus? These are people who had the demons cast out. These are people that were on the fringes of society. First of all, just being a woman, you're on the fringe. You didn't get invited to this meeting of the Pharisees. You had to break the party. You had to come in, you know. You weren't invited. And then you're a woman that had 8 demons, you know. Or however many it was. But these here, and one of the things that I'm very sure of is that even by the time the Gospels were written, probably the way that Jesus operated, we have to look for clues in the Gospels if we can't tell exactly. And I think that Jesus was really attempting, I don't know if he was successful, of setting up an extremely sort of egalitarian, healing-oriented, love-based group of people that followed him. And it's very clear from this one that the women were central to that. But probably more central than even the Gospels portray, because the Gospels tend to portray that the disciples, as 12 men, were most central. But I think, this is my opinion, you don't have to agree with me, that it was probably even more egalitarian than what the Gospels portray.
Yeah.